Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. Patricia Pearson is an award-winning writer. She's won 2 National Magazine Awards, a National Authors Award, and the Arthur Ellis Award for Best True Crime Book. One of her novels, Playing House, was nominated for the Stephen Leacock Memorial Medal for Humor. She's contributed to major newspapers in this country and is a member of USA Today's Board of Op-Ed Writers. She's a wife and a mother and the author of a new book, A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine, which has just been published by Random House. It is an insightful look at the fears and anxieties we all have, as well as how to recognize and cope with them. Book retails for $29.95, and it's very good. Her bio also states that she met the Queen when she was little because her grandfather was former Canadian Prime Minister Lester B. Pearson. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Patricia Pearson. Good morning, Ms. Pearson.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
What is the difference between anxiety and fear?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting and important distinction because we tend to think of them as the same thing, but fear is essentially the quality that sharpens your senses. So, you know, a train comes rushing down the tracks just as you're crossing over them, and you take action immediately and jump out of the way, and you have an adrenal rush, and then your body calms down as you resolve the situation. Whereas with anxiety, it paralyzes the senses because when we feel anxiety, we don't tend to know where it's coming from exactly. We're not quite sure how to take action against the menace that we're feeling. It's often quite diffuse and or, you know, long-term. For instance, if you're feeling anxious about climate change, it's not like you can immediately take a specific action that's going to make climate change go away and protect you. So those kinds of diffuse threats to us have the effect of making us feel quite paralyzed.
You give the analogy in the book of sitting at the edge of the Grand Canyon on a sofa or a bench, and then could you explain that? In another instance, you're feeling like you're over the cliff.
Yeah, that was actually a dream that I had. I have never been to the Grand Canyon, but I had a dream that I was lying on a sort of like a Victorian settee, kind of cushioned bench, and I was admiring the beautiful vista of the Grand Canyon, thinking, "Wow, this is so marvelous. It's so lovely to look at." And then I suddenly realized that the bench I was lying on was suspended over the canyon and was only connected by the end where my feet was to the canyon wall. So I was immediately filled with an absolutely, you know, compelling sense of terror that if I moved in any direction for an inch, I'd fall. And I have a fear of height, so that played into that fear. Of course, anyone would probably they realize they were on a bench over the Grand Canyon. And so then I thought about it later after I woke up. Why did I have that dream, or what could I learn from it? And I realized that a lot of the sort of early theorists about anxiety in the 19th and early part of the 20th century were saying that you can't get shut in by anxiety. So if I stayed on that bench, I would protect myself from falling off either side, but I'd also spend the rest of my life as a still, paralyzed form on a bench. So you have to be able to figure out how to move through it, even if it's literally going inch by inch until you reach solid ground. So that became sort of interesting to me that my subconscious had come up with that image.
That feeling of terror, though, is that what do you feel that all the time? I mean, you have a list in the book of things that you're afraid of. Is that what you sort of feel whenever you think about climate change or running out of gas or something like that?
No. I mean, it anxiety will run a spectrum, and there are certainly the phobic response for people is probably the most loaded with that level of terror. And it can often be completely irrational. So, you know, you can be having this kind of extreme fear of garden peas, or there was a woman in England who had a fear of garden peas that she had to run out of restaurants to get away from them. Or it can be pigeons, or it can be quite arbitrary. But it tends to be very loaded with fear. Panic attacks are also very extreme. I have never had a panic attack, which is much more sort of physical, kind of almost feeling like you have a heart attack. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, where I mostly reside, is worrying. So excessive worrying about things, as opposed to being completely terrified. So I manage to go through, you know, my daily existence quite well, but I worry a lot.
How does it manifest itself, this worry? Are you kept up late at night and things like that?
Yeah, it takes the form of you know, sort of fretting and analyzing and planning backwards and planning in French and trying to, I mean, I don't actually do this anymore because this process of writing the book really helped give me better strategies, but it used to be very much that I would feel that if I could somehow analyze something to death, then I could control it, that if I could foresee every possible outcome of a scenario, whether that be the possibility that a tornado was going to hit my house, or, you know, it could be fairly random. And you see it more broadly in society, I think, with our attempts to control health issues. So if you can only just figure out exactly and precisely what you don't do to get cancer, then you won't get cancer. You know, health policy tends to be played out almost in this kind of anxious mode of thinking, where you can somehow control it, and of course you can't.
You were afflicted by this at an early age, were you? Or is this something, like, I mean, are you, I should ask the question more clearly. Are you more, do you get this at an early age, or is this something that you develop over time?
I think...
Like, were you always anxious, Patricia?
What the research... No, I mean, I don't remember realizing I was anxious as a child, actually. I thought all children were as paralyzed in the darkness as I was, and I certainly wasn't in the daytime frightened, so... but essentially, most people inherit an anxiety proneness, or they don't. So, and that's essentially their neurobiological wiring. So, some people will be more easily startled, more easily aroused to fear by just their sheer wiring. And then, whether that develops depends on the situational stresses. And in my own experience, I haven't been consistently anxious. There have been life events that have thrown me into a state of high anxiety that's lasted for, you know, 1 or 2 years at a time. And the rest of the time, it's a sort of more calm kind of landscape.
Is it safe to say that we're all anxious, but we just deal with it differently?
No, I think there really are people, as hard as it is to imagine, I've met them, there are people who actually don't feel anxious, and they don't get it. When you are anxious, they just think you're being a nervous Nelly or a sissy. So it is interesting. It does definitely have some temperamental characteristics to it. And the same thing with depression, of course. I've never really been particularly prone to depression, but there are lots of people who have mixed anxiety and depression. My grandmother was one.
Hey, talk to me about your grandmother. We read about her over the years, and we'd read about those sarcastic, colorful comments that she'd make when she was with your grandfather on the stump and so on. Was that a manifestation, do you think, of her own anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, she was very irritable, I must say. As a grandmother, she wasn't exactly our favorite grandmother. You know, God rest her soul, but she was really quite snippy. And I think it was a combination of factors. I think she was frustrated that she was a first lady rather than... She had wanted to be a journalist in the 1920s, in that kind of early spring of feminism, a sort of period in the 20s where there were flapper girls and it looked like it might be possible for women to advance more, and then it kind of rolled back. So she had some early ambitions that got flattened a bit, and I think that she carried that with her in a way that, because of her temperament, because she was prone a bit to depression and anxiety, she couldn't really let go of it and make the most of what she did have, which of course was a lot. She had an abundant life filled with opportunity, but she was pretty cranky.
How does the spouse deal with it? How did your grandfather deal with it?
Well, I asked my mother that actually the other day. I was curious about that, but he was very easygoing, my grandfather, very comfortable in his own skin, and I think my mom's opinion was that my grandmother was apparently very beautiful as a younger woman and very charismatic. So he was basically in love with her, romantically in love with her, and then, you know, the rest just came with the package.
For your husband, how has he dealt with your anxiety?
He's been really, really patient with me, and I, too, with him and you know, some of his travails. So, you know, I think we've really managed to honor those vows of, you know, through sickness and health. And I think that, you know, it was ultimately quite important to me to marry somebody who would understand what it was like to be vulnerable to those kinds of stresses. I had some earlier partners in my life who really just did not understand that at all and would make fun of me and so on. So, I landed in the right spot marriage-wise, put it that way.
In terms of motherhood, did that frighten you?
No, I never extended my anxiety to parenting, you know, oddly. I think the anxiety is very idiosyncratic in terms of where people place it, where they invest it. And I just, for whatever reason, never worried about my kids, and still don't. I still, you know, I'm pretty laid back with them. And it's important to me that I see anxiety developing in my daughter. Like, she's got the sort of proneness to it. So it's really important to me to come up with strategies for her that are maybe somewhat different than what I was offered in my childhood, which was, you know, don't worry. Well, you are going to worry, so can we come up with something a little better than just say don't worry? So Clara and I talk about, you know, the ways in which she can, you know, stop this kind of catastrophic thinking that she does.
You write about that in the book. You're tucking her into bed one night, and she's worried that someone will kidnap her.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think when whether it's that or monsters under the bed or in the closet or something like that, do you think parents tend to underestimate the children's fears?
I think they definitely underestimate children's fears, because it's only now becoming apparent through neuroscience that the way children's brains develop, they literally can't tamp down their five alarm signals. So when they get fearful, it's the same thing as when a two-year-old has a temper tantrum and they can't stop themselves. They don't yet have the control in their physical brain, the regulatory control, and they have the same problem with fear. So we really underestimate just how intensely afraid children can get at night. Or in the day, for that matter, with their fear of dogs or phobias.
How does one manage anxiety? Are there remedies, I guess, other than prescription ones?
Well, increasingly, and I think this is really important, that increasingly psychiatrists and psychologists are beginning to look at sort of integrative management, where it's not just stick somebody on a pill and let them deal with potential side effects and costs and so on, but rather let's look at the whole body. Let's look at the way we can change our automatic thinking patterns through cognitive behavioral therapy. Let's look at the way that we can regulate breathing, make the body calm itself down so that it doesn't sort of fuel panicky thoughts. Certain kinds of yoga are really useful for that. Mindfulness and meditation have been shown to be really helpful. Certain kinds of herbal supplements are beginning to get double-blind, placebo-controlled studies. Placebo studies, so that, you know, the evidence is behind them rather than just anecdotes in the health food store. And so I think in the next 10 years you're going to be seeing more of a shift away from the pure biological model and toward a more thoughtful, perhaps less invasive ways to deal with anxiety and stress.
Does God and perhaps faith, I should say rather than God, faith, does that strengthen the soul perhaps?
Well, it does. It really does. I mean, it's an interesting quandary. Because if you don't believe in God, it's not like you can just go and, you know, buy a week's worth of faith at the corner store and try it. So, but if you do happen to believe in God, then it does actually help. So the data does show that people of strong faith, and it's partly ritual, it's partly the community and the ritual involved in faith, does bring down levels of depression and anxiety.
Where do you think the genesis of you being anxious, where do you think that came from? Is that something that you're born with, perhaps? Or, I mean, I was just reading your bio, you covered a lot of, you know, crimes and trials and things like that, and it seems gruesome almost. Do you think that perhaps fed into that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I certainly stepped on some rakes over the course of my life, partly because I didn't recognize the need to buffer myself. I didn't understand that I was somewhat vulnerable through my proneness to anxiety, and so I went and became a crime reporter and covered the trial of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, exposed myself to a lot of sort of upsetting material until I finally learned my lesson and realized I had, at a certain point, just had to accept that I was not the sort of person who could follow her curiosity in these directions, that I did have to protect myself more. And I was talking to my niece about that because she's a teenager, and she's just been blithely following along with the other teenagers as they all go to see Saw and, you know, these really, really violent horror movies that have just become par for the course with
them. Right.
And, you know, I was trying to explain to her that she really needed to buffer herself and protect herself from, that not everybody could just go and expose themselves to this kind of stuff. It, you know, can get very toxic. So I had to learn that.
As a society, are we more anxious than, say we were 20 years ago, 50 years ago?
Well, I think the data on that is kind of equivocal. So I would say that from what I've seen, it's more a question of the 20th century being us being more anxious rather than the last 10 years or the last 50 years. I think anxiety and depression have both come out of the closet as things that people talk about, so that kind of skews the data as well. But certainly, the further away we get from, you know, traditional institutions and traditional village structure, family structure, the more isolated we become, the more, it's not that we become more anxious, but we're less protected from, you know, we're driving ourselves a little bit crazier, I think, right now.
You had a statistic in the book about Americans being very anxious, and there was another statistic about Mexicans not.
Mm-hmm.
How does our societal, I guess, our makeup of the society, our culture, how does that affect whether we're anxious or not?
Well, it appears that what's going on there, this is from the World Health Organization's World Mental Health Survey from 2002, and it appears that there are certain cultures where, you know, people may get anxious, but it doesn't become this existential gnawing on the furniture business that it is here. And it seems to be that societies that have, well, you know, for instance, in Mexico, most people in Mexico, you know, are still living in their cities and towns of origin. They still have their family around them. They have a lot of fiesta, a lot of collective ritual. They're very Catholic. So they seem to be able to keep that kind of sense of almost existential anguish at bay. I mean, obviously they have real fears, but those are actionable. So, you know, things having to do with the politics of the place and so on, and poverty issues. But that's a different feeling. It's not that sort of diffuse kind of feeling of anxious isolation that we have in the further northern part of America.
And for Canadians?
Canadians seem to be somewhere in between. So Americans really take the cake in terms of their levels of clinically significant anxiety. And, you know, at one point in the 19th century, there was actually an American doctor who called anxiety I think it was an American illness or an American nervousness, having to do with this sort of imperative to succeed at all costs, and that if you pursued the American dream, you would be rewarded, and, you know, the 99% of people who don't make it onto American Idol and that you don't see lauding the American dream are the ones that are feeling anxious because they feel like they've failed. So that mythos there seems to elicit a lot of anxiety, I think.
For you, where did you find, I guess, solace? Where did you find sort of your solutions? Was it through medicine? Was it through faith, perhaps?
I think for me it's through a combination of factors. So part of it has been this ability to disengage from my anxiety so that I observe it. When I feel it now, I observe it as if it were back pain, and I don't throw my soul and mind into it and get involved in this kind of dance with it. I'm able to separate it a little bit more from myself, and I guess that's a meditation technique, although I have no patience for meditating, but it's that idea of detaching yourself from your sort of autonomic nervous system and just watching what's going on. So partly through that, partly exercise, silly as it sounds, is a big factor. When people are anxious and depressed, they tend to not do the things that will help. And one of them is, you know, pretty rudimentary. It's like if you do 45 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes of exercise a day, you're going to keep your anxiety levels at bay, just, you know, purely by calming your body down. So doing that, I'm trying to go to church. It's kind of a new experience for me, but it's getting sort of subtly deeper all the time as something that helps me.
It must have been odd to have to face your anxiety at the same time writing a book about it. Was it easier? Was it harder?
It was hard, yeah. It was actually, you know, it's like mucking around in the basement of your soul. And on the one hand, it was useful because I came across a lot of really interesting insights that I was not aware of that really helped me. On the other hand, it was, you know, I mean, there's a whole body of thought about how people who have experienced, you know, various forms of trauma in their childhood or sexual abuse or whatever, shouldn't go to the psychologist and replay these things instead of helping them. It actually makes it worse. And something along those lines was my feeling of, oh my God, I don't want to have to think about, you know, the time I was 22 years old and I got anxious. Or so it was funny. But I'm glad in the end that I did it. I think it was useful, and I think it's useful for people who've been reading it. They found insights there that I'm just passing on that I found by sort of rummaging around in the library.
What are you working on now, Patricia?
I've actually just finished a documentary on the science of the soul for the History Channel, and now I'm going to develop a documentary on the anxiety.
I want to thank you for appearing today, especially in the light of events of recent weeks in your life.
Thank you.
And I'll congratulate you on this book, because it is a fantastic book, and I must say it's helping a lot of people, I'm sure.
Oh, thank you very much.
Continued good luck with it, Patricia, and thanks for joining us again.
Okay.
The book is called A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine, published by Random House, $29.95. For the commentary, I'm